Well, as Neil just announced, we plan to spend the next two or three days in the study of the Book of Daniel. He also mentioned the fact that we'll do this in the light of the message of Sabbath rest, which we looked at the last time I was here several weeks ago. I'll just give an extremely brief review of the main principles of the Sabbath message by turning back to Hebrews, the third chapter. We'll pick up the main thought that we developed when we were present last time. We say the great deal from Hebrews, the third chapter, in verse 10 and 11, where God is speaking to the inspired apostle. Wherefore I was grieved with that generation, and said, they do always err in their hearts, and they have not known my ways, so I swear in my wrath they shall not enter into my rest. Now God plainly said about those people, they have not known my ways, so I swear in my wrath they shall not enter into my rest. Now God's rest, I should emphasize perhaps first of all, the text does not simply say they shall not enter into rest, but into my rest. And elsewhere in chapter 4 we find that Paul refers to God's rest, his rest, or that rest, as the case may be. So this then is a very special kind of rest, which is much more than merely cessation from physical labor. It's that peace which passes human understanding, and the Sabbath is inseparably connected with that rest which God offers to his people. And very obviously, those people who fail to enter into God's rest most certainly will never find a place in the eternal kingdom. This verse then makes it very, very clear that the most important search in which man can be engaged is to understand just what God's ways really are. In the last study session, we learned that Israel, when they left the land of Egypt and travelled through the wilderness to the promised land, were given lesson after lesson in what God's way of government is for his people. And God's way of government for his people does not involve men being their own problem solvers, their own plan makers, their own burden bearers. For instance, when God called Israel out of Egypt, he didn't say to the elders through Moses, you men sit down and devise a plan. Bring it to me for my blessing, and according to that plan, lead the land of Egypt. God made the plan. All they had to do was to accept it and to follow it and to move out in accordance with that. And while Israel did that in their journeyings from day to day, as they crossed the Red Sea, as they came to Mount Sinai, as they built the sanctuary and so on, they had nothing but unqualified success, perfect security, and a journey which had no defects apart from their own stumblings and grumblings. When they came to Kadesh Barnea, they then decided to turn away from God as their plan maker to themselves as plan makers, sending the 12 spies into the land of Canaan, an activity which was purely of their own planning and devising, and the result was miserable and total failure, and not one of that generation entered into the rest of the promised land. They all perished out there in the desert. So learning God's ways is much more than merely learning to recite the Ten Commandments. It means to understand the way in which God works with his people. And of course in the Bible we are given ample illustrations of how this is to be done. Since I was with you last time out to the East Coast and back, and I was in Norman, Oklahoma 2 or 3 days ago, it was last week I guess, and I passed by a Protestant church, I'm not sure which one it was now, and outside was a sign which read, God does not make a promise and then fail to deliver. I thought to myself, how is it that the Babylonians, and we recognize of course those churches to be such according to the spirit of prophecy, receive such astonishing answers to prayer when in fact their prayers do not ascend up to God but to the enemy, as early writings page 56 plainly tells. As I pondered upon the matter, I came to realize that Babylonians take solutions to God, and Christians take problems. And Satan is very happy, of course, to answer the prayer in just the way that the Babylonian desires it to be answered. Whereas, of course, God's solutions to our problems can very, very often be very different from our expectations. Now, in the light of the principle we learned 2 or 3 weeks ago in regard to Sabbath rest, we'll now go back and look at the book of Daniel. Daniel has tended to be categorized in the minds of people, Adventist people for that matter, as a book which can be summed up as having two divisions, a story part and a prophetic part. The story part is splendid for telling children about the burning fiery furnace, about the lion's den, and the prophetic part is excellent for learning about the rise and fall of political powers down to the history of the ages. However, I want tonight to present to you, or begin to present to you, the book of Daniel in a very, very different light altogether. I want you to come to understand that the book of Daniel is literally a preview of the final struggle of God's people. That the experiences through which Daniel passed are in principle the same experiences through which God's folk will pass in these last days. And that Daniel was as successful as he was because he understood the principle that God is the source and we are the receivers. But Daniel made no plans for himself, even as Christ made no plans for himself, as you read in Desire of Ages 208 and Ministry of Healing, page 479. God was Daniel's problem solver and was a true illustration of the experience of God's folk in the last days, of whom it will be written, or it is written, in Testimonies to Ministers, page 300, where Sister White says, "Let me tell you that in this last work, God will work in a manner very much out of the common order of things, and in a way that will be contrary to any human planning." Now, if God will finish the work contrary to any human planning, then how much human planning will there be in the final work? None whatsoever. What place for committees? None whatsoever. What place for men over men? None whatsoever. Who alone will make the plans to be followed out by God's true people in the last days of human history? God will. At last, God will fully and completely occupy his place as the plan maker and as the problem solver and the burden bearer for his final people. And because of that, they will be totally and completely successful in their final mission. Now, I made the observation, I was with you folk 2 or 3 weeks ago, that you may search the Bible through from cover to cover, and every single time that God's people let him be their plan maker, their burden bearer, their problem solver, they experienced nothing but total success. There was no such thing as failure, loss, impossibility, or defeat. Now, in the book of Daniel, we find that principle vindicated, because Daniel found himself face to face again and again with the mightiest king on the earth at that time, a man who commanded the greatest army then in existence, a man of great education and intellectual strength, of tremendous personal determination. Yet every single time Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar met in head-on conflict, who was the outright winner? Daniel. He couldn't lose. Therefore, Nebuchadnezzar could not win. Desire of Ages, page 490, Sister White says that with Christ there can be no such thing as failure, loss, impossibility, or defeat. And that is the picture that we find brought to view in the book of Daniel. And likewise, the people of God, as they go forth in their final conflict, because like Daniel they know who their source is, they know that they're receivers, will like him know no such thing as failure, loss, impossibility, or defeat. And because of that, the work at last can and will be finished. We'll turn now to the first chapter and begin with the first verses of this book. And we'll take this as a verse-by-verse procedure as we proceed from one point to the next. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried away to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, and of the king's seed, and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well favoured, and skilful in all wisdom, and cunning in knowledge and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and tongue of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meats, and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end of thereof they might stand before the king. Now among these were of the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names, for he gave unto Daniel the name of Belteshazzar, and to Hananiah of Shadrach, and to Mishael of Meshach, and to Azariah of Abednego, or some people say Abednego. Let's pause a moment now to gain a sense of the historical situation which existed there at that point of time. I see you bring some chalk, Neil. Where'd you put it? Oh, thanks, good. There are in the Bible three great powers. There's the king of the north, there's the king of the south, and there's Israel. Throughout the book of Jeremiah, the king of the north is brought to view as being Babylon. The king of the south is Egypt. And Israel, of course, is God's people. Now, these are the only three powers that you find in the world at any time in human history. Now, certainly, of course, there are subdivisions to each of those powers. Modern Babylon is made of apostate Protestantism, the Roman Catholic Church, for instance, and the national powers which give their support to the Babylonian system. Egypt, we're plainly told in the book Great Controversy, page 269, is atheism. And today, of course, there are various forms of atheism in the world, the communist form, the Islamic form, the heathen forms, and so forth. Now, back in Nebuchadnezzar's day, obviously, of course, he was the king of Babylon, and Babylon represents counterfeit religion. That religion which professes to be for God, but which in fact is anti-God and anti-Christ. Now, the history of that time shows that, first of all, King Nebuchadnezzar marched against and conquered the Egyptian power, then turned back and conquered Israel. But now, when Nebuchadnezzar conquered Israel, what he really conquered was apostate Israel. So let's now make a distinction between apostate Israel and true Israel, or the true Church of God. Now, in actual fact, there is not much essential difference between apostate Israel and Babylon. Because what in effect is Babylon? Babylon is man in the place of God, right? Man making himself to be his own problem solver, his own burden bearer, and so forth. Let's come back to remind ourselves, for instance, of the experience of the Jews in the days of Christ. As far as Christ was concerned, who alone was his plan maker? God. Perhaps I'll read again the statement in Desire of Ages, page 208, where we're plainly and distinctly told the fact of this. It's also found in Ministry of Healing, page 479. The statement reads, "So utterly was Christ emptied himself, he made no plans for himself." He accepted God's plans for him, and day by day the Father unfolded his plans, that is, to Jesus Christ. Now turn across now to another statement in the same book, Desire of Ages,
But
we're told there that the one rule of the life of Christ was the Father's will. Page 486. The one law of his life was the Father's will. So day by day, Christ looked to God, and God was Christ's plan maker. And nobody else. But the Jews in the days of Christ, together with the apostles as well, became increasingly restive about the plans which God made for Christ. And they wanted Jesus Christ to add his power to their plan to liberate them from the Romans. At the feeding of the 5,000, the faith of the people became very, very high. And they were confident that Jesus Christ was the man to effect their salvation from the Romans. But they saw no disposition on Christ's part to carry out their plan. So what did they do? They had a meeting, they consulted together, they formed a plan, and they decided to force Jesus Christ to follow their plan in the place of God's plan. In short, what did those people do? They put themselves in the place of God. And when man tries to put himself in God's place, then what is that man building? Babylon, right? The mystery of iniquity of Babylon. They come back to the history of apostate Israel in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. And what was that history? It was the history of the Jewish people putting their plans in the place of God's plans. Again and again, the prophets, Jeremiah and Isaiah and others, were called upon by God to appeal to them to come back to God's ways with the promise that if they would, then God would certainly save them from their enemies. But they chose their own ways again and again and again, and by so doing, they built up within themselves the Babylonian system. So even though we call them apostate Israel, in effect, what were they in effect? They were Babylon, so far as their practices or ways were concerned. Now what makes Babylon is not just a name, not just an organizational structure. Babylon is a way of life, a way of doing things, in contradistinction, of course, to God's way of doing things. However, when a church falls into apostasy and becomes spiritually dead, inasmuch as the Bible correctly says the dead know not anything, then can a spiritually dead people ever truly understand their real situation or condition? They can't. It's not possible. So apostate Israel thought that they were still what? True Israel. They thought that. And because they said they were dead, they couldn't see differently from that. Now likewise, when Nebuchadnezzar went forth to fight against apostate Israel, who did he think he was fighting against? True Israel. He thought he was overcoming the invincible people, namely God's true people. But to his pleasant surprise, he found it not very difficult to conquer Israel. Well, I guess there was a struggle, but he was successful in battering down the walls of Jerusalem and taking the entire nation captive. Now for Nebuchadnezzar, that was a triumph of the greatest proportions. After all, Israel had a very, very illustrious history. They crossed the Red Sea, they conquered the land of Palestine. In the days of David, they had subdued the then known world, and they were in fact a nation with the most illustrious history of any nation back at that point of time. And therefore, when Nebuchadnezzar overcame apostate Israel, he felt certain that he had won a victory which would assure him of perpetual domination of the world. And what Nebuchadnezzar did not know was that he had not yet met the true church of God. And it was not until Nebuchadnezzar came face to face with four young men, and let's just now try and grasp the picture. Four young men who were but youths, who had no military training, who had no weapons, who were captives in a foreign land, who to all appearances were completely in the power of Nebuchadnezzar, who by their numbers were so insignificant as to be hardly worthy of notice. That was the true church of God at that point of time. Now, I'm not saying, of course, for one moment that there were not other faithful believers in the land of Egypt, because no doubt there were other faithful believers too. But so far as the records are concerned, the only members of God's true church that were introduced to in the book of Daniel are four youths, four young men. Not a great multitude, but only four young men. And these four young men were four amongst a larger group. How many we don't know. If you look now at verse 6 once more, it says, now among these were of the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And of course the number that they were amongst the larger group were the young men chosen by King Nebuchadnezzar to stand in his court, to eat his meat and drink of his wine and so forth, and to be prepared for a very, very large place in the future role of the kingdom. Now, I wonder how many there were. There might have been 50, there might have been 100. There might be only 20 or 30. We just don't know. But what we do know is that those four young men were only a small section of a much larger group. Now, when the test came to them, we find that the way in which those various young men related themselves to the problem varied. Daniel and his three companions did it one way, and the others, of course, in turn did it the other way. Now, before we go into the way in which they dealt with the problem, let's now come down to our own time to recognize that the same forces are in the world today. For instance, do we have a mighty power called Babylon, which is seeking world domination at the present time? We certainly do. Do we have another power called Egypt, which is contesting Babylon's quest for supremacy? We do. Atheism, as I mentioned previously. I'm just going to read now a statement from the Great Controversy, page 269, which identifies Egypt as being atheism, not a geographical nation to the south of the land of Palestine, because the geographical method of interpretation has no place in the interpretation of Bible prophecy. I'll make a few quick comments upon that point, or that principle. There are two ways of understanding the symbolism of Bible prophecy. We have, for instance, a number of references to the kings of the east, the king of the north, the king of the south, to Egypt, to Babylon, and so forth. The tendency is on the part of some folk to simply look for that power which occupies their geographical direction or location as the case may be. But nowhere in the spirit of prophecy is that method of interpretation endorsed or supported. First of all, we find that the book of Revelation, which is the unfolding of Daniel, is the gospel of Jesus Christ. In counsel to writers and editors, there's a statement in regard to this where Sister White makes it very plain that we are to study the gospel of Jesus Christ. The page is 175 in the book Counsel to Writers and Editors, where Sister White specifically says that the book of Revelation is the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, the gospel principle is, it's not a matter of where you are, but a matter of what you are that makes you to be who you are. And you know it's a simple principle. If you live here in Walla Walla, for instance, and then you move to, shall we say, South America, does that change your geography, change your character? Well, of course it doesn't. Not for one moment. So therefore, it's not a question of where you are, but what you are that makes you to be who you are. And that principle is very plainly stated in the Great Controversy, page 269. The great city in whose streets the witnesses are slain and where their dead bodies lie is spiritually Egypt. Of all nations presented in Bible history, Egypt most boldly denied the existence of the living God and resisted his commands. No monarch ever ventured upon more open and high-handed rebellion against the authority of heaven than did the king of Egypt. When the message was brought to him by Moses in the name of the Lord, Pharaoh proudly answered, "Who is Jehovah that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I know not Jehovah, neither will I let Israel go." This is atheism. And the nation represented by Egypt would give voice to a similar denial of the claim of the living God and would manifest a like spirit of unbelief and defiance. Having laid this principle down, Sister White then says, according to the words of the prophet then, a little before the year 1798, some power of satanic origin and character would rise to make war upon the Bible, and the land where the testimony of God's two witnesses should thus be silenced, there would be manifest the atheism of the Pharaoh and the licentiousness of Sodom. This prophecy has received a most exact and striking fulfillment in the history of France. In other words, in 1798, Sister White did not look to the geographical location of Egypt as being the power symbolized by Egypt, but she looked to where atheism was the dominant power as the place where Egypt was to be found prophetically in 1798. Now, geographically, of course, France is quite a long distance from Egypt, and furthermore, it's not south, but to the west, or even northwest from the land of Palestine. So very obviously, in this interpretation, geography has nothing to do with the case whatsoever. Egypt is atheism, and the vast communist world and the heathen world is the modern spiritual Egypt of today. Now, at the present time, as you recognize, there is a balance of power, a very uneasy balance of power between those powers. Pardon? Great controversy. Now, at the present moment, there is a very uneasy balance of power between the nation that supports the Roman Catholic or apostate Protestant system, which is Babylon, and the nations which are the stronghold of the atheistic ideas, namely, of course, Islam, communism, and so forth. Now, just as it was in Daniel's day, so today, as Daniel 11 points out, the king of the north will first of all completely conquer the atheistic world. Just let's run across to Daniel 11 to see that, just briefly and quickly. And I'm watching with great interest the development of the confrontation between the Islamic world at the present moment and the United States of America, because this is a very direct confrontation between the king of the north and the king of the south. And verse 40, I wish I had time to go through this whole chapter in detail with you, we don't at this moment anyway. In verse 40 of Daniel chapter 11 it says, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him." Now, time of the end, of course, was 1798. That's well known to Adventist minds, or should be. And this refers to what took place when the Pope was taken prisoner by General Berthier, the French commander, who came, of course, from what was then the atheistic power, as I read to you a moment ago from Great Controversy, page 269. But now it says, "And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, and with horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries, and shall overflow and pass over." Now that's still future, but not very much in the future. You may say to me, well, does that semicolon there symbolize a gap of almost 200 years? No problem, it does. Let's turn across to Revelation 13. Keeping our fingers in Daniel chapter 11, we'll be right back there in a moment. And we'll compare now Revelation 13 and verse 3 with Daniel chapter 11 verse 40. Verse 3 says, "And I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death." Now that took place back in 1798. We all know that, because that's good old fundamental Adventism. "And his deadly wound was healed." Now, has that healing yet fully taken place? And the answer must be no. The process has been going on, and the healing is almost complete, but not yet has Rome recovered the power of the state to enforce her decrees. And not until she does will that deadly wound be completely healed. So in this verse we have a semicolon, which represents again a gap of something like almost 200 years. And as a parallel verse to Daniel chapter 11 verse 40. And coming back to Daniel chapter 11 again, We have the statement that the king of the north would come against the king of the south like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen, with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. Actually, the word countries is supplied. If you have a Bible that italicizes a supplied word, you recognize it's put in there by the translator. It was not there in the original. And it should simply be, many shall be overthrown. In the Revised Standard Version, it says tens of thousands shall fall. Now, what is the glorious land? Now, once again, do not give a geographical interpretation of this, because each of these are symbolic terms, and the glorious land is very obviously, of course, the churches which claim to be God's true people. In other words, exactly as Nebuchadnezzar back there entered into the glorious land and took apostate Israel captive, so in these last days history will again be repeated. Now, very clear proof that these terms are symbolic is found in the fact that Edom and Moab and Ammon are mentioned. Today there are no nations upon the face of the earth which are descendant from those three former powers. They have been literally eliminated from existence. There are no Edomites, no Moabites, and no Ammonites present in the world today. If we're forced to find those people who are symbolic or antitypical representations of those folk back there, they are, of course, those people who will escape out of the various Protestant churches. Sister White talks about them as being ministers and people who will leave those churches and join with God's true folk in these last days. Now, verse 42, he shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. And Egypt, of course, is atheism. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be his steps. Now, this pictures, quite correctly, a successful world conquest on the part of the Babylonian power. And we know, don't we, that the Roman Catholic Church, or the beast as he's called, is going to obtain complete dominion over the world in these last days. Complete dominion. Every nation upon the face of the earth will follow at the footsteps of Rome. Every nation. And of course the United States of America will be, as the bastion of apostate Protestantism, will be the chief instrument in giving back to the papacy her lost power. Now, what I want to make very clear at this point is this, that history will be repeated. That just as back in Daniel's day, Babylon first of all subjugated the king of the south, which was Egypt, and then turned upon apostate Israel, and then met true Israel, so it will be in these last days. And Daniel chapter 11 makes it very, very clear, as we've read so far, that first of all, the king of the north will subjugate the atheistic world, the communist and Islamic world. Then he will enter the glorious land and will gain possession of the apostate church of God, the professed people of God. And then last of all, he'll come face to face in his confrontation with the true people of God. As verse 44 points out, the tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. Now, I don't want to go into a great deal of proof on this tonight, because I want to get back to the main point of my message. But we're well aware that in the last days it will be the loud cry of the third angel given on the power of the Holy Spirit, which will infuriate the Roman power and cause him to go forth with determination to destroy the true people of God. Just a few quick words from the Great Controversy on this, where Sister White describes this confrontation in the chapter entitled The Final Warning. Page 606 and 607. It says, the sins of Babylon will be laid open. The fearful results of enforcing the observance of the church by civil authority, the inroads of spiritualism, the stealthy but rapid progress of the papal power, all will be unmasked. By these solemn warnings, the people will be stirred. Thousands upon thousands will listen and have never heard words like these. In amazement, they hear the testimony of Babylon as the church, fallen because of her errors and sins, because of her rejection of the truth sent to her from heaven. As the people go to their former teachers with the eager inquiry, are these things so? The ministers present fables, prophesy smooth things to soothe their fears and quiet the awakened conscience. But since many refuse to be satisfied with the mere authority of men and demand a plain, thus saith the Lord, the popular ministry, like the Pharisees of old, filled with anger as their authority is questioned, will denounce the messages of Satan and stir up the sin-loving multitude to revile and persecute those who proclaim it. There are the tidings exposing the sins of Babylon, laying out the very nature of her constitution and government, her way of doing things, and in response to that, the popular ministry, which will then have possession of the entire world, will be enraged and will stir up tremendous persecution to prevent and then to destroy the people of God who give that message.
Are you placing that in the time sequence of after the conquest of Babylon and going into the true, what you were calling the true Israel then? I've heard that applied as happening today. It's the principle of the presentation of truth. That's why I question.
Well, wherever the truth is presented, it'll generate persecution. That's for certain. But the time sequence here, I'll go back a little bit on page 606, where it says, thus the message of the third angel will be proclaimed, as the time comes for it to be given with greatest power, and so forth. Now, the time when it's to be given with greatest power, of course, is when the latter rain descends upon the church. And that'll be the sounding forth of the fourth angel's message. We're plainly told that when the Sunday law is passed, at that point of time, the image of the beast is formed. So here then is the image of the beast. And when that law is passed, the sins of Babylon will then have reached unto heaven at that point. And when the sins are reached unto heaven, then it'll be time, the time will come for the announcement to be made that the sins have reached to heaven. And that, of course, is the message of Revelation chapter 18. So that not until that Sunday law is passed will the actual descent of the latter rain and fullness of power take place. And when it takes place, of course, that produces the loud cry of the third angel. Before that time, there is a swelling of the message to that point. And when, of course, the loud cry begins, then comes the persecution, imprisonments, fines, and so forth are leveled against God's people. Then comes the buy and sell decree, and finally will come the death decree down at the very end of human probationary time. And that is the last great test for the people of God, by which their destiny is determined. Then comes the close of probation, the time of Jacob's trouble, and the time for the execution of the death decree around about the fourth and fifth plagues. That's a very brief and simple outline of those order of last day events. Now, prior to that point of time, when the Sunday law is passed, there must come the conquest of the king of the south, the subjugation of the apostate people of God, where they may be found, and then will come, when there emerges in latter rain power the true people of God, then will come the confrontation between the King of the North and the true Church of God at that point of time, which is prefigured in the experiences that Daniel had in his confrontation with Babylon back in his own day. That's because the book of Daniel is a preview of these mighty events and of the specific experiences of God spoken in the last days, that it is of tremendous value to us at the present time. And therefore, as Sister White plainly points out in Testimonies to Ministers, around about page 12 or 13, I think it is, that the books of Daniel and Revelation should be studied, and when they're studied in the light of the gospel, they'll bring to God's people an experience the like of which they have not known before. We'll find fresh courage and fresh direction from the experience of those men with whom God was able to work so magnificently and like them will have courage to go forth, knowing that we shall know no such thing as failure, loss, impossibility, or defeat. I'd like to turn to a statement in the Bible commentary in regard to this, in which is laid out before us the certainty that Daniel understood who his source was and never failed to recognize his relationship to that source. It's in volume 4 of the Bible commentary, page 1170, and comes from the view and held of January chapter 11, 1906. In Daniel's life, the desire to glorify God was the most powerful of all motives. He realized that when standing in the presence of men of influence, a failure to acknowledge God as the source of his wisdom would have made him an unfaithful steward. And his constant recognition of the God of heaven before kings, princes and statesmen detracted not one iota from his influence. King Nebuchadnezzar, before whom Daniel so often honored the name of God, was finally thoroughly converted and learned to praise and extol and honor the King of Heaven. Now the conversion, of course, of King Nebuchadnezzar was an astonishing achievement. And today, the equivalent would be the conversion of the Pope of Rome, because that's the position Nebuchadnezzar occupied. Now I'm not going to say, of course, that we can expect that the Pope of Rome will, as a matter of course, be converted. It's possible, but not certain. But Nebuchadnezzar certainly was, back at that time, thoroughly converted to God, and we can expect to find him in the kingdom of heaven when that kingdom is finally set up in the very, very near future. I'll conclude with that thought for this moment, as our time has gone for this session, and when we meet again, we'll pick up this theme and look into the way in which Daniel, by recognizing his source, was able to meet very successfully and triumphantly every encounter that he had with the King of Babylon of that time, and that there is the promise that we shall do likewise as we also go forth to meet the Prince of Darkness in the near future.
We'll have a pause for 15 minutes. And if you have any questions, perhaps in the meantime, if you would like to ask for the right, I'm going to throw open the windows a bit more and the door between the crowd of people in here and my football stadium lights over there. It does get a bit warm.
So, there's lights at the main thing. 2 months set off.
Yes, I'm going to. The lights have a vacation for everybody. Cool things down, too.